This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
A warm hello to you. This is Lana Lochteff. The guest you're about to hear has intriguing and insightful ideas to share. His name is James Bowery. We'll first discuss his interesting background in IT, then move on to talk about his theory of Jewish virulence, which is analogous to immunosuppression virulence. We'll hear his hypothesis about the horizontal transmissions from which this virulence has evolved. This theory is complementary to both Kevin McDonald's thesis documented in The Culture of Critique and to Richard Fauchetti's niche theory. We'll also discuss nations as superorganisms. The pre-Christian Northern Europeans had a culture that recognized the dangers inherent in group organisms, which they called giants, serpents, vipers, and dragons, depending on the characteristic of the organism. James explains how civilization is group selection and group selection is war. So what are we evolving? He says this question must be asked before we talk about what kind of a system is best for our people. Later, we'll explore a little bit of pagan history and culture, and James also talks about sacralizing natural heterosexuality in what he calls the state of nature. So stick around because there's a whole lot more in between. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lana.
Well, as we get warmed up, please tell us about your background as a pioneer in IT.
Being 60 years old, I've got quite a history, so it goes back quite a ways. I started out doing computers when I was in junior high, really, programming a little Wang calculator. So had Nixie tubes. Mm-hmm. People probably don't even know what Nixie tubes are. Their readout was basically neon numbers. But and there was a waffle iron that punched cards you manually. So that goes back pretty far. But really, I got my start in a major way with the Plato Network, which was a computer-aided education system that was experimentally run by the National Science Foundation out of the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. I was at Iowa City, the University of Iowa, but we had a Plato terminal there hooked in across the state border, and I wrote up, first of all, I was involved in a graphics computer graphics for artists course. I was sort of their nerd, helping the artists get their stuff done. And I ran across this graphics terminal that, for the time, was pretty amazing. Back in 72, 74, when I ran across this, there was a 512 by 512 resolution and graphics resolution. So for the time, it was really revolutionary. And I got into it very rapidly and did the first, I guess you'd call it the first-person shooter multiplayer game over the network. It was called Space Sim, and got involved with a lot of early work in telecommunications. Did one of the first email systems with the PlatoCom project. Took off from there, went to work at Control Data Corporation in Minneapolis, St. Paul, as a system programmer on the Plato system. Tried to take it mass market, but even though we got the system demonstrated that could go to mass market, the corporate heavies didn't want to take it that way, and they decided they wanted to stick with the highfalutin corporate customers instead of mass market. So they missed their chance to be the internet. Mm-hmm. 18 years early. I could keep on going, but
yeah, I'm curious about virtual reality and also what we now call blogs and your first online newspaper. Tell us about those.
Well, I didn't really do the first online newspaper. The virtual reality was really the primary thing that I did that was really first. And people are familiar with it now. You get online and you play all kinds of different games online with other people in a virtual reality. And back then, it was just basically stick figures. You had these 3D stick figures that were floating around in space, and you could fly them around and do various things. And I had based my system for my game on the Star Trek mythology due to the fact that a two-dimensional game called Empire on Plato had done the same thing, and I sort of did a 3D takeoff on that with my own modifications to the way in which you'd win, which since I had been sort of involved with zero population growth as a, a pubescent, really, I was very familiar with limits to growth and the Club of Rome model, which really focused on limits of terrestrial resources.
Mm.
And since I was dealing with space, I started looking at how you could incorporate space resources into that. And I did a little takeoff of my own of the Club of Rome model, which incorporated non-terrestrial resources as a way of winning. And that was before, actually, there was another guy that came along and wrote a book called Doomsday Has Been Canceled, Peter Feig. And he was sort of trying to make an argument against Paul Ehrlich and the limits to growth people, zero population growth people, that you could expand the ecological range of humanity off the Earth, and in so doing, at least forestall the limits to growth problems till you had, you know, say a factor of 1,000 more population of humans than could be supported on Earth. He came out with that a couple of years after I did the game. So I think I probably can claim that I was the first to incorporate non-terrestrial resources into the limits of growth model. There was a newspaper that I was involved with. Maybe this is what you're referring to. When Controlled Data Corporation decided not to pursue the mass market, I was pretty alienated because I had sort of led a team of guys to demonstrate this, where the corporate guys had demonstrated that we could support enough users that it would pay for all the hardware and service costs. And then I discovered that a newspaper chain called Knight Ritter, out of Miami, in fact, it was the Miami Herald, was the newspaper at the time that was looking into going into electronic newspapers, advertised. Somebody at Plato knew that I was interested in mass market approaches to this whole thing and gave me the ad. I went down there, interviewed, and they gave me the position of the future architectures position. So I worked on that down there in Miami. And we made some pretty good progress in terms of trying to come up with what we nowadays would think of as the web. This is back in 81, 82, 83, in that time frame. And there were some difficulties at the time with AT&T being split up. It was a monopoly that people were sort of trying to deregulate or break up so they could deregulate the components. And Western Electric was producing the terminal, so we were stuck with their hardware design. Turned out a lot of the stuff that I wanted to get done wasn't supportable on their hardware. So I ended up having to scale back my plans on that and looked at some other hardware designs that could support something that's more along the lines of what the Macintosh became a few years later, except it would have evolved into something that would have supported the Smalltalk, which is a lot of the nerds out there, they know what I'm talking about, and they know this is pretty advanced at the time. But it was sort of like JavaScript is these days in the web browser, except you would have it running in these little terminals. Anyway, so we took off and tried to put together architecture like that, and it turned out that there were certain deals that had been cut in the back room for Tandem Corporation to be the vendor of the central computer systems, and we simply couldn't do the architecture that I had laid out on that mainframe. So I resigned and took off to San Diego and started to do something on the IBM PC, which was a real tiny little computer, but I could do a chat system on it at least. So we got one of the first sort of real-time instant messaging systems with a bulletin board running in San Diego, and ran across some folks that had assistance from the military, the early versions of the internet. And we didn't have that access to the military's internet, so we had a hard time competing, and wrote some letters to try to, you know, get them to stop assisting assisting private competition and that sort of thing. Didn't really succeed very well on that. So I just proceeded on to do normal run-of-the-mill consulting with Science Applications International Corporation down in La Jolla. From there, I took off up to Silicon Valley and did some work with the Xanadu guys. The Xanadu guys were really the first hypertext system. The primary programmer there, Roger Gregory, and I took off and did a rocket engine together.
It was nice.
Kind of a strange story I could go into, but it's a sort of a side story. A lot of the people who are into this stuff are into space stuff, as you might be able to glean. Jeff Bezos has his own rocket company. Elon Musk has his rocket company. John Carmack, who ended up doing a first-person shooter game, I got to know him peripherally from that, did a rocket company. So it's the kind of thing where when money gets sort of shaken loose from Wall Street and sort of rains down a little bit on us nerds, what we always do is something like rockets. It's just so much fun. So that's from there, I took off to work on Hewlett-Packard's so-called Internet Chapter 2, which is they called it the eSpeak project. They had budgeted that to, if you could take into account all of their promotional stuff, which included like a 4-page center spread of the Wall Street Journal and a lot of really expensive promotionals, it came up to be almost $500 million they were spending on this Internet Chapter 2 project. And I had a pretty good idea what to do. You know, I had a lot of background with the Internet. So, I couldn't figure out what they were trying to do over there. They kept on trying to get me to go work for them. I had already glued together a bunch of their websites in a federated login system in the early web days, and did that relatively successfully for them. So they went from a bunch of disconnected websites for the different divisions into a unified login structure. Nowadays, you have things like that with Facebook. You can go to any website and log in with your Facebook account, for example. So that was the kind of thing that I did back around, I guess it was 97, 98 for Hewlett-Packard's various divisions. And they were trying to get me to go work on this thing, and I couldn't figure out, I heard the words, Internet Chapter 2 and all the grandiose stuff, but I couldn't figure out technically what they were up to. It didn't make any sense to me. Maybe I was just dumb, I don't know, but I couldn't figure it out. So what ended up happening was I said, look, I have a pretty good idea what needs to be done. I was doing this stuff back in the early 80s, and I developed some ideas beyond that, and so I'll tell you what, I'll come work with you if you let me pursue what I see as my direction here. And to a limited extent, they agreed to that. So I was able to go over there and to had some freedom to pursue some stuff. That was when I ran headlong into what became really the end of my career because of ethnic nepotism on the part of people from India. What happened was, there was one guy that I needed to hire who had been actually working for Paul Allen's interval research in Palo Alto on some very advanced mathematics in support of quantum computing. And it turned out this was related very much to some of the non-determinism you have to deal with in network computer systems. People, that's technical terms, but I just have to get it out of the way for the record. Anyway, so I this is one guy I wanted to hire him. He had a Ivy League education. He had he was like the world specialist in this area. And I was told no, I could hire all of the guest workers from India that I wanted, but I couldn't hire this guy. And I said, I resign.
Did they give you a reason for why you could only hire Indian workers?
No, it was just sort of understood that I was this guy that was going to be a front for importing people from India. I mean, that was sort of my, the message that I got. That's why I resigned. I mean, I had things were happening. This is a point in time when, things were really, happening, all kinds of things. I mean, for example, I passed up the opportunity to go work on PayPal for this, for example. I mean, the early days of PayPal. And so, you know, I said, you know, I'm out of here. And they said, okay, no, you can go ahead and do it. And I got them in. We were able to do a few things. And then basically they marginalized that we left. I was not real motivated after that to work on this thing, because it just seemed like there was, what I saw going on was basically a huge amount of money being spent by the founding company of Silicon Valley for the purpose of getting guys, primarily Brahmin class out of India, away from their equivalent of affirmative action over there and escape over here into positions where they were competing head to head with guys like me who had, you know, really been founders of the information age in the United States. And, you know, they were asking me to not hire this guy who clearly was, you know, he was a national treasure, if not a world treasure in a particular area. But anyway, so I was kind of dismayed and disappointed. Not all that surprised from the standpoint that, you know, I sort of saw this coming with all the H-1B visas and everything. But at that time, there hadn't been, I mean, there was such a huge growth in jobs. Nobody was really impacted by the big influx of H-1Bs. It was only at the dot-com collapse in spring of 2000 that it became clear that what was going on was that the limited jobs that were remaining were being locked down by all these guest workers, and all the guys who had been around there for decades were all sent back to the Midwest. They were sent packing the mountain states, Midwest, Pacific Northwest, wherever they came from. And so I decided I'd go to the Pacific Northwest for a while. And that's what I did.
Now, today, we wanted to talk about your theory of Jewish virulence, but how does that connect with your background? When did you start investigating further into Jewish activities?
Well, that was really as a result of having gotten involved with legislation at the federal level in privatizing launch services. I was chairman of an organization called the Coalition for Science and Commerce. And we got the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Ron Dellums, together with a write-in Republican Orange County candidate or congressman to co-sponsor legislation to privatize launch services. It was really kind of a strange coalition, but it worked. And the point of that was to get the government out of picking winners in terms of technologies for launch services. And I did this, you know, not as a professional thing. This is just purely a grassroots kind of civic activity on my part. And I made some substantial sacrifices to get it done. And as a consequence of working on this, it became apparent to me that, you know, the arguments that they always make about this kind of stuff, what the people I call techno-socialists, the arguments they always make is that, oh, this stuff is too risky for the private sector, so we have to have the government backing the technology. And the problem is that government funding is through politics, and politicians and the people that they pick to be the experts are not the right people to manage risk.
Sure.
In technology development. So you really need to have people with their own money on the line to you know, really know what they're doing, because they've proven that they know what they're doing because they made the money in the area, and they have a lot of motivation to control risk. And so it's really the right thing to do to have it in the private sector. Technology development, that is, in the private sector. Science, where you're dealing with something that's not even patentable, you know, you can't have intellectual property in a scientific discovery because you can't patent laws of nature. That's another story. I can get into the philosophy of how you get that funded. But the main thing is I discovered that there is a capital market failure. And the techno-socialists have a point in the following sense. There's, at the base of our economy is this sort of, you know, if you want to call it the Federal Reserve System. There's an interest rate at the base of our monetary system that in economics, say modern portfolio theory, is called the risk-free interest rate. If you have this risk-free interest rate at the basis of all of your capital, you're essentially providing welfare, in a sense, to people who are wealthy. And you're subsidizing wealth in an amount that's approximately equivalent to the risk-free interest rate under modern portfolio theory. So that's bad, because you don't want to, you know, it's one thing to have people who are not economic decision makers being welfare queens. You know, they're you know, off in the ghettos or wherever they are, you know, and sometimes they actually need it. But whatever the point is, that if you have somebody who's wealthy and you're subsidizing their wealth, you're making them lazy with the wealth that they've got. And that debilitates their ability to, or handicaps their ability to make good, sound risk judgments and to put their capital at risk. So I came up with a tax reform to deal with this. It was a net asset tax that was linked to the interest rate on the national debt, which is sort of like this risk-free interest rate, and also tied that to what I guess nowadays would be thought of as the unconditional basic income, a citizen's dividend, to try to bypass a lot of the bureaucracies and what's called the public sector rent seekers. And wrote up a study, did some of the math on the macroeconomics and the microeconomics, and passed the paper around to some think tanks in Washington, D.C., found that there was a reality. The reality there is you've got think tanks that are being paid by people who are wealthy, and there's a real problem with that, of course, because they have a conflict of interest. And the same thing goes with the Federal Reserve. But when I started shopping this idea around, it was like the people who had, I was on the internet early, and so I was in discussion groups on Usenet about these things. And one of the things that I noticed was that the names that kept on coming up were Jewish. And part of the reason I knew, I mean, I had been sort of noticing this because I had been in the newspaper industry and down in Miami, you know, I was working in Miami Beach, and it's very heavily Jewish. I had for some time sort of gotten a sense that there was a cultural mismatch between the people in charge of the media and the pioneer population in the United States, what I call the Nation of Settlers. And I hadn't really identified it as Jewish per se, but I thought, you know, Jews might be sort of a part of this whole thing. I didn't really see them as central to it. But as this capital market failure fix that I was promoting started getting these, you know, really vicious arguments coming back at me, and people were like indefatigable in their arguments, it became apparent that the people in the economics profession, as well in academia, as well as media, we were dealing with a human ecology, if you will, of very highly proficient arguers, you know, debaters, that had an agenda that was not aligned with the interests of the Nation of Settlers, that the people that I identified with coming from Iowa. You know, my father, you know, volunteered to go fight in World War II against Hitler, and, you know, took pride in that. And, you know, there's, as particularly as the decades went on and the Holocaust became more and more of a substitute for Christianity or Christ in terms of the, you know, innocent victim of the world being, you know, destroyed by evil. You know, that sort of became a way of translating one's religious affiliations into the broader secular propaganda, if you will. So I was thoroughly familiar with what became the evangelical Zionism and evangelical identification with Jews in a way that they could sort of ride the coattails of the hundreds of Holocaust movies that made it into the secular culture of this new religion.
Hundreds, I'd say thousands. Well, if you include all the Holocaust references in film and TV.
Well, there's like two. I think the number is like 220 something like that. Holocaust movies, and there's actually a website that documents all of these things. They're just basically they're not against them. It's just here's this genre. But in any event, that was something that sort of set me off, and I started looking around at stuff from William Pierce about who runs America, or I can't remember the name of it. This thing about the media control, which of course Jews themselves make no bones about. The book An Empire of Their Own was by a Jewish guy, and so that got me thinking about this problem. It's like an ecological problem, if you will, of this particular, very intelligent, very verbally competent, and very self-interested group that can push their agenda in media and academia and religion.
Yeah.
Because, if anybody forgot where the Bible came from and, who Paul was and, all the rest of that stuff, it's really kind of a funny thing how Christians can't think about the fact that the same people that wrote the Bible are also writing a modern mythology. Everybody quotes all the time. People used to quote passages from the Bible, as sort of their mythological vocabulary. And now it's, well, you remember that scene in that movie, new visual vocabulary that people have for their myths. So yeah, very clearly, once you start down that path, it's very difficult to do anything but place the Jewish phenomenon at a very central point, at least in the West.
Well, you said in your theory of virulence that it evolves around horizontal transmission. And before we go deeper into these transmissions, can you please define what horizontal transmission is?
Well, yeah, it's really kind of simple, and it's obvious as opposed to vertical transmission. All it is basically, imagine you're an organism, you're a germ, and you infect another organism. And you have two ways of making it into the next generation. One way you can make it into the next generation is along with the organism that you've infected. That's called vertical transmission. In other words, you and the reproductive interest of the organism you're infecting and your reproductive interests are aligned. Horizontal transmission is basically take the money and run. You don't care about whether the organism you have infected lives or dies, because you can transmit yourself to another member of the same species that is not the offspring. And that's the fundamental distinction. Now, where this really becomes relevant is in a field that's called evolutionary medicine. There's a book called Plague Time by Paul Ewald that I recommend that people get, just in general, especially with the Ebola epidemic that's coming out, just so they understand how the evolutionary dynamics of diseases. Well, if you think about nations as our bodies politic as sort of superorganisms, where they've got various organs of state and they've got people that are operating in specialized roles, and there are bounds to it, and there's sort of an inside and an outside to it. You can think of these things as being organisms that aren't mobile. They're sort of sitting there locked down on a piece of land, these nation states, if you will. And they grow. They have an organic life to them. You can think of them maybe as a plant, as a vegetative form of life. Or some people might think of them as slime molds, because of the way in which the individual people, individual components can act individually, but then can form together into cohesive groups the way slime mold cells can. Be that as it may, if you look at the origin of, say, the Spanish flu that wiped out so many people in the early part of the 20th century, Paul Ewald has a theory about that having to do with horizontal transmission, where it depends on there being a large number of immobile victims. In that situation, you had a large number of people in the war trenches in these hospitals that were bumped up in high density together, and they couldn't move. So if somebody had a disease, they could be very sick, you know, deathly ill, and they were close enough to other people that couldn't get away from them, that the organism could jump, and it could do so even if the victim, the prior victim, was completely immobilized by the illness. And this is how the really seriously virulent organisms evolve, is where you've got a bunch of immobile hosts that can't get away from transmission between them. So if you think about nations as a bunch of sort of locked on their beds victims in World War II, yep. Right? And then you have border controls, which, you know, prior to governments, you had individual males, like in any sexual species, the males will tend to be combative and prevent a great deal of diffusion of at least the Y chromosome. And you can see that in the geography of the Y chromosome. Female chromosomes tend to be more spread out because females are more welcome, especially the young, fertile ones. But if you have the nation state taking over their role of the individual males, and then you get some group that figures out that they don't have to wage war to change the border to be able to win against these other groups. They can be a nation state without a geography. All they have to do is violate the borders and get across the borders and then do their group work inside of another nation state. It acts as a transmissible virus. If the nation states then don't have an immunity to this, this group organism that can cross these borders figures out that being able to penetrate borders is really key to its survival, you can get a very nasty evolutionary dynamic going on that it actually does two things. With the Jews, the way it works is you have a mercantile culture that tends to toady up to the central powers, the elites, the kings or whoever, and helps them centralize wealth and power. So it becomes hyper-centralized and becomes alienated from the people, the people that are tied to the soil. With that much centralization of power and wealth comes the opportunity to be able to grab it and run. Well, clearly, if you have a society in which the elites are becoming more and more alienated from the population because of the centralization of power and wealth, there's likely to be a revolt. And if there's enough perception about what's going on, and Jews are involved in this, people are going to become, quote, anti-Semitic. And at that point, you're going to have a lot of Jews that, of course, are not particularly that virulent. They may just be people who are like the Germans. There are German Jews that are very much identified as Germans. And they fought in World War I, and they consider themselves to be, you know, fully German. They had just happened to have a different religion. They didn't really identify as part of this alien organism. But that's not all the Jews. So what ends up happening is that you get this reaction against the Jews in general, and then, of course, the Jews that are the nasty ones would say, see, you're victimizing all these innocent Jews. And it's true. You are. You know, if decent, very, in fact, maybe even genetically German people that just happen to have converted, let's say. And so what ends up happening is the virulent Jews take off with the wealth across the borders, leave the relatively innocent Jews, some of them completely innocent, there to take the heat.
Sounds like the transfer agreement in 1933.
Yeah, well, the transfer agreement was there wasn't that much wealth that was absconded with. What really happened there was almost an antidote to the kind of virulence that I'm talking about. See what they were trying to do is actually set up their own state, their own nation state, where they would be responsible for tilling the soil and all the rest of it. And if you see some of the early Zionists that were part of this, you know, some of these people, they have some pretty nasty things to say about diaspora Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, that's not to say that as time went on, you know, a lot of the virulent Jews showed up in Israel and started playing their Zionist games that we're all familiar with. But I'm saying that as a fundamental agreement, that was a lot less virulent than a lot of the other things that have been going on with Jews over a long period of time. Where it's nasty is where you get them coming into some place where there's already an existing nation state that they then co-opt. And although there were people there, you know, there wasn't the kind. They really did establish their own nation state. It wasn't somebody else's nation state that they established. They did it with the assistance of the British, and with the assistance of the Nazi regime, but it was not like they came in and took over, say, the United States the way they did, which has caused just untold damage. So, yeah, the transfer agreement. I mean, I've read Black's version, you know, of that history, and you know, it's a very interesting and convoluted and not at all black and white history of the origin of Zion, or at least the origin of Israel as funded by the Nazi regime and the transfer agreement. So, yeah, I have a problem with people who are just strictly anti-Zionist. I have a problem, of course, with the way Zionism has become an influence in other nations around the world, because that's really playing off of the Jewish virulence already in place in those nations.
Well, it would be great if they just stayed in their state. just stay there. Well, you have your homeland. Go there.
Well, precisely. And I think that there are a lot of Jews that would have been happy to do that. But part of the problem here, of course, is in the Jewish religion, there is a supremacist aspect to it. And so there are going to be aspects, even among people who are sort of strictly Zionists, are going to be sort of trying to fulfill the destiny of Jews being the priests and princes of the world, et cetera. I don't know what the exact terminology is, but it's clearly a supremacist religion.
Yeah, it seems like the best Jews got to get out and go in 1933, and then maybe the ones that weren't their best and brightest were left behind in Germany.
Well, yeah, when you say best, yeah, that cuts both ways, because you see, it's like Charles Murray wrote this book about the Jewish gifts, and you know, my complaint about that is, look, you know, you really have to include the sign plus or minus on this magnitude of gift. If you're very gifted and you apply that in a very negative way, it would be better if you weren't gifted, you know. And there are people who, and this is the problem, you get very gifted people of both a positive and a negative character escaping from these anti-Semitic outbreaks. And the Jews of the negative character will continue the anti-Semitic cycle. So, yeah, they're gifted. And the thing is that there are some very negatively gifted people that escape with a lot of wealth and influence. And that amplifies the problem. It evolves in an even more virulent strain. So having something like a nation state that is kept away from its imperialist ambitions, however those are expressed, covertly or not, or overtly, is very important.
Well, the first point of horizontal transmission you highlight is the hyper-centralization of net assets. And you say that this can be done in any kind of system, whether you're communist or capitalist or in a monarchy. So before we move on to other points, I wanted to know what your thoughts are on other systems also, such as the Austrian School of Economics, the free market, National Socialism. In your view, do any of these systems have something truly beneficial for our people?
Well, I'd have to say that you have to look at it in a different way. Civilization is a regime, is an evolutionary regime of group selection. And what I mean by that is, if you have two people ganging up on a third person and they win, that's group selection. And civilization really is based on that. If you have, and even the Austrian school, where they supposedly are all about the individual, they aren't. Let's take, for example, young man and a young woman, young lovers that fall in love, and they want to start a family. One of the first things they're going to do is plant a garden and build a little house. And they're going to need to do that on some land. And let's say you've got Ted Turner, who owns, you know, a million acres up there in Montana, something like that. And they just happen to be there. And there's, you know, a couple of young animals in love. And they just plop down on a piece of land. Ted Turner's not around. And they start growing their garden and have it, you know, the woman and the man make love, and she gets pregnant, and they have a child. And then here comes the Austrian School of Economics with Ted Turner and a bulldozer. Okay? And it's like, no, I do not agree with this philosophy of property rights. This kind of individualism is against nature. Now, if we want to talk about civilization and property rights that are centralized beyond those that we can have in a state of nature, in other words, where Ted Turner has some kind of moral standing to go get rid of that young couple off of his land, boy, we have to do some talking, okay? And that's really where I came up with my citizen's dividend, the net asset tax, as sort of the basis of civilization being you have a mutual property insurance company where everybody, all of the people, are their shareholders, and they have a stake in the creation of wealth. So the protection of wealth is a service provided by the mutual insurance company. They're all stakeholders. They receive a dividend for that. They come to the defense of Ted Turner when he needs to have his property defended. But on the other hand, this young couple now has a stipend with which they can go ahead and rent land from Ted Turner and have their family. So that's why the asset tax that's linked to risk-free interest rate coupled with the citizen's dividend is so central, in my opinion, to having a humane kind of civilization. Now, having said that, you still have the problem of how you keep any kind of civilization, any kind of nation state or organization from becoming corrupted by centralizing influences. Because you'll always have people in a position where they can take whatever forces are available and, you know, produce movies about how these people over here are bad, so we got to go get them, right? And that's sort of the way, you know, priests have been doing things, and it's the way Jews do things with their movies and newspapers, etc. That was what was being fought by the America First people. You know, Charles Lindbergh, you know, basically said the word Jew, and he was almost drummed out of society for saying that in 1941 in Des Moines. So this problem with group selection is really, it really ultimately ends up with what is known in zoology as eusocial species, like the ants, the social insects, etc. That's the ultimate expression of organization. And one of the things that sets Europeans, particularly Northern Europeans, apart, and one of the things that kept us from being civilized for so long was our emphasis on the individual's right, especially the individual male's right to satisfaction in combat, mm-hmm, against anyone for any reason. It was considered to be his essentially God-given right. As he was if there's natural law to be discussed here,
not the proxy that, violence like we have today,
right? It's an individual thing, not two people ganging up on a third person. That's unfair. Fairness is where you look across the various sexual species and you see that there is no escaping conflict. Conflict is part of nature. Force is part of nature. But the question is, what are you evolving? If you can't answer the question, what are you evolving, and believe in the direction and the evolutionary direction that you're taking, you really have some thinking to do before you start talking any further about what kind of society you're trying to build. So my approach increasingly has been over the years twofold. On the one hand, we have to face the fact that group selection is war, whether it's direct overt violence or violence of the state against the individual. Group selection is war. It's group against group. And that's one of the things that has been, that's the wool has been pulled over our eyes about the nature of civilization. This is one of the things that makes it so that particularly Northern Europeans are vulnerable to invasion by group-oriented cultures, such as the Jews, but not just the Jews. There are all kinds of, basically, there are very few cultures in the world that have placed this kind of emphasis, on the biological emphasis on the individual. So we have an instinct about fairness and individuality, that, and elevating the individual as the vanguard of evolution that is not present in other cultures. And we have a difficult time even imagining other peoples being as group identified as they are, because it just doesn't come to us naturally. In fact, it comes to us almost as an immorality, which is why when we see it in other people, we then are willing to consciously say, now we have to join forces as individuals in defense of our freedom as individuals and defeat this monster. Now, the old term for the monster was a dragon, in terms of the armed forces that were invading our peoples. The sneaky group organisms were vipers or serpents. But these are very ancient terms that get back to our mythology, the roots of our mythology. This is where I have some differences with a lot of the people who are attempting to do a revival of the pre-Christian religions of our people. I don't think that they understand how central these distinctions are.
No, we do. We like to hear about this.
Well, then I'll simply say this. The state of continual war that was imposed upon our people before Christianity by the various empires creates in us the need for kings, where a king is somebody that we elect. This is one of the things that was sort of set us apart from other peoples. They were relatively temporary, especially in Western Europe, relatively temporary positions of war leadership, where an individual would stand up and say, we have to go slay this dragon. And there would be people that would agree with him. And if he could get enough people, then he would become the king. And it was a temporary position. But if you have perpetual war, then the position of kingship becomes perpetual. And now you have the weakness where the Jew can come in and toady up and separate the royalty or the nobility from the people, especially if there can be some kind of an excuse made to prevent that elite from being challenged to single combat to the death. And clearly, if we look at, for example, the Revolutionary War in the United States, one of the things that was going on back in that era was single combat was still recognized as being a respectable form of dispute resolution between men. George Washington had to request that his officers cease and desist this behavior while they were at war. And the reason is very clear. You can't have this kind of infighting if you have to have a very unified organism yourself to fight off another organism that's very unified. Mm-hmm. You have to have absolute obedience. Every individual has to give up their individuality to the leader. But it has to be understood that this is a temporary arrangement. That's where the declaration of war becomes crucial. Your declaration of war also declares the state of peace, which means everyone knows when the war is over. If your declaration of war doesn't tell you when the war is over in a way that people can understand, it's poison. It creates a perpetual state of war, and that's what creates the moral argument to protect the leader from challenge to single combat, because you can't afford to have that kind of disruption of authority during war. So one of the tricks is perpetual war, which means perpetually protecting the leadership from challenges of a matter of honor, from the people that are out there. And then that creates the place where you have centralization, where Jews can take over. And that's what happened with Christianity. We had first, in fact, if you look at some of the mythology and go back and read Wolfram's book, The History of the Goths, the Amal clan is really the origin of the Aesir. And the notion that Odin is the god of kings and the god of war comes directly from this concept, is a direct consequence of this perpetual war creating a king kind of situation. And the conflict between the Aesir and the Vanir, this is my theory, okay, is essentially a conflict between the relatively kingless West of Northern Europeans and the Goths that were in a transition from pre-Christian to Christian to Aryan, not Aryan, but Aryan Christianity, involving the Amal clan. And there, Wagner's Ringsockel gets into some of the stuff as well from the same era. But this perpetual war thing is very poisonous, and it really attacks our ability to act authentically as who we are, in our very blood. Now I have to to some extent defend the rest of humanity, in the following sense: this tendency toward eusociality and group conflict is not something that they invented. It's more like something that Northern Europeans decided to escape with, I think, the assistance of dogs, believe it or not, going back to like 15,000 years. Because dogs were a substitute for a hunting pack. And instead of having to have a gang to go out and hunt the way you did in Africa, you could now have an individual man with his own hunting pack. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the word dog is such an idiom within ethnic gangs. It's, hey, dog. They sort of understand at a basic level the role that dogs have played, at least in Northern European evolution, and that when you reduce humans to pack animals, they are, in a sense, reduced to dogs. And we have to understand that's not where we want to be as a people. On the other hand, we also have to understand that we are at war. And that's where we have to come to a very conscious decision about what is our organization to wage war, whether it's violent or political or subversive the way the Jews do it or however you want to view it. The question is, how can we organize, recognizing that we are at war? We are not dealing with individuals. We are dealing with serpents, with vipers, with dragons invading our lands. And how can we organize ourselves in such a way that we understand what the declaration of war is and what our state of peace is? So.
And at this point, it takes organization outside the state, because the state is virtually our enemy.
Oh, it is the dragon.
As anti-white as it gets.
Yeah, the state has become the power and principality of darkness, to use the Judeo-Christian subversion of our people. Yeah. So yeah, it's one of those, and this is one of those things. No matter what you do, anytime you form one of these mass organisms to fight another organism, you are creating a monster, and you have to understand that. This is also one of the reasons I think that we had a tradition of killing our kings. I think the people, there's this idea of the sacrifice of the sacred king. I think that may have started with one of these kings standing up, one of these war leaders standing up and saying, we will accomplish this. And boy, if he failed, it was his ass on the line. He died. And I can even see a rationale for it being a custom. I don't know if this is the case, but I can easily see it being a rationale for being a custom where if you're in a perpetual state of war and someone wants to take upon themselves the role of military leader, they have to understand that they are a biological danger to their people by having that centralized power, and that maybe they need to have built into that authority structure their own death within a reasonable period of time to prevent them from becoming one of these sources of corruption of the other against the people. That's more of, so much of our history is lost to mythology. You know, you go into Wicca and they have the sacrifice of the sacred king, and it doesn't have anything to do with war or being able to prevent this kind of corruption. And other people, the Golden Bough, Fraser wrote some things about this. But see, the thing is that because our ancestors were pre-literate, all of our records are being made by really enemy cultures. Mm-hmm. And we have to really look inside of ourselves and listen to our own authentic voices. But it's really hard to do that when our heads have been filled with these motion pictures and Bibles and all the rest of it. We really have to get away from that. And the best thing that I can suggest is for young men, especially in their teens and in their early adulthood, get out into nature and just isolate yourself. Try to listen to who you are and see if you can hear that authentic voice.
Your ancestors are part of your DNA. It's right in your body, so you should be able to access that and tap into it.
I strongly believe they speak to us. If we can only listen.
Now, do you believe in a natural kingship or an aristocracy? Do you think that that's what whites need right now? Do we need a leader? Hate to say it.
Well, we need to organize for war, and but the definition of war cannot be the definition that we are historically familiar with. You know, this idea that you get these, even not even guerrilla warfare. It doesn't have to be anything that's violent even. So to say that you need a king is, that may be something of an atavism, and it may even be very dangerous. I would say that if you're going to think along those lines, you better think along the lines of somebody who's willing to have themselves sacrificed. I mean, you know, quite literally and you know, not figuratively. It's like, you know, I am going to stand up here and, you know, either, you know, this objective that I am setting out to lead the accomplishment of is accomplished with people giving up their individuality to me as their leader for the duration of this campaign, and we succeed, or I am going to commit suicide or be killed by my retinue. Now, my opinion is that's not really the way to approach things right now. There's another approach that I prefer called sortocracy, sorting proponents of social theories into governments that test them is a sort of the idiom for the way I would describe it. And I've got some minimalist rules for sortocracy. There are just four rules I can read off to you real quick if you'd like
sure.
to hear them.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So keep in mind, what we're talking about is sorting proponents of social theories into governments that test them. That means we can still act as individuals to an extent. We all have different opinions about it. You know, some people are they're dead set on Austrian School of Economics, even though it was founded by Jews.
Yeah.
I can, you know, but they're dead set on it, you know, and I'm not going to try to argue them out of it. Now, other people are, you know, dead set on.
Actually, sorry, I just got to interject this. I think it was Karl Menger, actually. He was a non-Jewish German, but then later on comes Mises and Rothbard and all the Jews
right.
who kind of run with the idea. Yeah.
Right. But you get my point. There are all
sure.
kinds of different ideas out there, and we're all, you know, in fact, many people, you know, already have children that are mixed race. There are lots of guys that I know that they couldn't find a woman of their own race, and they ended up marrying an Asian. They have half Asian kids. You have people who just have adopted wholesale ideas that are outside of anything that identifies themselves and their people as being something worthy of preserving. And I'm not willing to write these people off. I think that for us to write these people off and declare war on them is a mistake. I think that these people need to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be reached through what amounts to an enlightenment approach, which is you can go ahead and you can pursue your hypothesis in human ecology with others of like mind. You cannot pursue it and impose it on other people that disagree with you. And then we'll see what the results are empirically. And in this manner, you have scientific ethics, which does not perform experiments on unwilling human subjects. In other words, you have true consent of the governed. And the other thing it provides you is controlled experiments. Control experiments are necessary to infer causality in social sciences. And that's something the social sciences don't have. And that's one of the reasons why I think that Jews have been very focused on the social sciences. They don't want to have experiments like this. They want to have a single social theory imposed from the center. Because if they have genuine experiments, there might be some experiments where Jews are excluded, and they don't want to see what the results of that would be. Okay. So that's one of the ways, that's my primary litmus test for a virulent versus non-virulent Jew. The non-virulent Jews will say to me, if I say to them, will you oppose me if I want to be part of a society that excludes you as a Jew? The non-virulent Jew will say, no, I do not oppose you. A virulent Jew will say, yes, I oppose you. And it's that simple. So the rules are the following. The word state as used here is going to designate a body politic testing a particular social theory. Okay. So rule number one, all states are recognized as having legitimate power to control entry to their territories by anyone for any reason whatsoever. Two, all states are obligated to provide relocation for anyone and their dependents requesting immigration. That's emigration, not immigration. Okay, that means they can leave. They can't come in necessarily, but they have everybody has an absolute right to leave. Okay, this does not necessarily include relocation of capital assets claimed as, quote, property, end quote, by those emigrating. Their dependents include any children that have not been given up for adoption. Number three, states are allocated territory by individual adults receiving a land rent stream that the state in which they reside may demand for the purpose of acquiring control of land for its residents. And number four, if no other state will accept a relocating immigrant, a state of nature must be set aside in which eusociality is suppressed, eusociality being group selection. It is suppressed by rules enforcing individual sovereignty, including death penalty and deadly natural duel. And I can read off those rules, but those are separate. In essence, those are rules that govern what some people might think of as a prison. Okay, except it's a state of nature. So for some people, it would not be prison. It would be heaven. Okay. So these four rules eliminates prisons, because the way prisons work is by exile. If you're less and less accepted by more and more territories, you have fewer and fewer places you can go to until you're ejected into a state of nature where you can be killed. And it eliminates war over territory, or replaces war over territory with this land rent stream. So a group of people can get together, pool their land rents to be able to acquire a contiguous piece of land over which they can perform their social experiment. And tyranny in all its forms are including liberal democracies, tyranny of the majority limited only by a vague laundry list of selectively enforced, quote, human rights, end quote. All those tyrannies are eliminated because you get to choose your social theory in conjunction with other people. So that's this is what I call my organization for war. Okay. This is still accepting that there is a group selection of a form, but people are able to organize into what might be thought of as coherent groups that then can, because they are scientifically ethical and they are scientifically based in terms of their interpretation of social theory, they are stronger than other groups. And so they have the morale to expand the domain of this sort of meta-governance. And when there is a opposing group that says, no, you can't conduct your own voluntary organization, like, for example, Jews would say, no, look, you've got some people who are anti-Semitic here, we have to invade. It's like, no, you can't do that. We will all join together as humans that support enlightenment values, and we will kill you if you do that.
So how do we get Europeans to realize that they're in a war?
Well, that's the part of the trick here. Nothing of what I've put forth here talks about war, except implicitly by saying, if you agree to this state of, quote, peace, unquote, then this Pax enlightenment, if you will, if you agree to this, then there are going to be external threats to it. Let's say, you know, Islam comes in and wants to say, no, you can't do that because everybody's got to be Islamic, or any kind of supremacist ideology that wants to come in and say, well, then you have the organization that you're protecting, which, you know, in mythology, in the mythology of the United States, we are defending freedom, right? So when we have some threat to the United States, we can all join together because these people hate freedom. Well, the problem is we're not free, and so it's kind of, you know, it's a lie, and it's hard to get people really motivated and get the morale that's necessary for war to really fight against these supremacist ideologies, including the Holocaustianity and liberal democracy and all the rest of this nonsense that's being foisted on people as though it were freedom. So this is not really asking people directly to recognize they're in a state of war, except insofar as if they recognize the legitimacy of this, they're going to recognize the illegitimacy of the current governance and therefore the need to possibly take forceful action. So it's an indirect way of doing it. What you're doing is you're saying, do you agree that people should not be experimented on without their consent? Do you agree that in order to infer causality, even in the social sciences, you need, and perhaps especially in the social sciences, you need control groups so that you have some purity of your testing of your ideals? If you can get people to agree on those two points, then you've got them.
Yeah, you know, people don't realize that right now, I mean, demonizing a native majority population and getting the minority populations to compete against them, it's a genocidal tactic, right?
Yes. Yes, of course it is.
I mean, I think the Bolsheviks did something like this, too. They were demonizing Russian priests and military officers and all those people before they exterminated them. So who's the one race you can criticize right now and say anything to?
Right. And so what this is saying is that, look, even if somebody is trying to create an environment that's similar to the one in which their ancestors evolved, I know that sounds evil, but, you know, just maybe, you know, like all other organisms who want to live in an environment like their ancestors evolved, and maybe it's okay for some humans to, even Europeans, you know? And the thing is that you when you start putting into those terms, people start having difficulty arguing with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then it gets to the point, oh, well, gee, you know, we have this history of, like, you know, racism and Holocaust and stuff like that. And you say, look, there is this tradition of not convicting people until they are proven guilty, or there's a presumption of innocence. Even Jews themselves will say, you should always give people the benefit of the doubt, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why are you removing preemptively the fundamental human right of these people to consent of the governed without giving them a fair trial? And yeah, you will get people still coming back and say, well, it's just, you know, but generally at that point, you're dealing with people who are, you know, of some other race. That are, I mean, seriously, it's like, you know, it's like a black or, you know, somebody who's really clearly being Jewish and just saying, oh, Holocaust, 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 you know. And at that point, it's like, well, sorry, we're not really, you know, we're just trying to deal with the fact that we have to eventually wage war on you when we recognize that.
Okay. Well, what happens?
Too bad.
Can we organize once we're a minority? Will it be okay then? No.
No, it won't be. And you know, that's that's one of the reasons why you can't, when we were the people who are aware of and willing to come out and say, look, this is genocide, we're already a minority, even among our own people, let alone our race being a minority already in the world. Okay. that's one of the reasons why I'm saying we cannot exclude all these people who have been brainwashed, and we cannot exclude all these people who have children and relatives in other races. We can't exclude Jews who are willing to act as humans, okay? If they're going to be reasonable human beings within this regime of enlightened sortocracy, then we treat them as humans, okay? It's just when they cross that lines, all bets are off.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've seen a lot of infighting between a lot of different factions of European nationalists, and they're just, to me, it just is bratty, and it's a waste of time. I mean, we're in a dire time here. We need loyalty, we need unity, we need brotherhood. So, I mean, for me, I don't care if you're an anarchist or a Nazi or a Christian or whatever. As long as you have your folk in mind and you're willing to unite for the cause, I'm happy with that. How about you?
Well, right. And that's the point here, is that people are not always in a state of, not a active warfare mindset. People are thinking, we have to organize our society in this way, we have to organize our society in that way. And that's where we're being divided.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying, yes, absolutely. You get to go ahead and have your National Socialist regime over here free of Jews. And these guys over here, yeah, you get to have your libertarian, you know, lesbian, whatever you want to do. Okay. You can, you know, all these divisions that are dividing people and making it so that people don't recognize that there is a common enemy are taken care of by sortocracy. And then you've got a condition. Once people understand, oh, gee, now I get to have the life that I wanted to live. I can live in the kind of community I wanted to live in. Once they realize that they actually can have the kind of community that they wanted to live in, and they don't have to be fighting with these other people, they can start to realize that they have common interests. But I don't think they can until they get that.
Yeah, I agree. But I'm with you. I think there's so many differences among white people that it's got to split off into different kinds of groups and tribes. But we're far from there right now. We're like in a battle, so we can't even be talking about organizing into what kind of house we're going to build, because the house is being destroyed right now.
You know? Right. That's why we have many different houses. That's why we make it so that you have the right to join together on territory with other people that share your social theory. And that's where you get people to agree. You let people agree to disagree on these peripheral issues, and then to start to organize around that. And once you've got them agreeing to organize around that, then you can start to take on these other powers. Now, I'm not going to go into all of the stages that you need to go through to get to the point where we actually have a military, you know, but I don't even think you need to have a military. I think there are other ways of dealing with this problem. And, you know, I could talk at length about that, but that's another story. That gets back into my history with technology and space colonization and things of that nature. But there are some things we can do that are not directly violent warfare that can actually, in a sense, you know, give these, what I would call subhumans, give them what they want. But see, the thing is, what they want ultimately is these sort of ant-like colonies where they're all sort of around each other and this angelic group. And there are ways of technologically enabling them to have that. It's sort of like, think about the way cities are. Cities are these human ecologies, very high density population areas. They don't take up that much land. And if you can get those cities so they're more ecologically isolated and their agricultural basis does not take up as much nature, then you can have something that is more compatible with the way our people relate to nature.
Well, that's why lately, you know, I personally don't want to live in Agenda 21, but I feel like if all these immigrants are coming in, come on in, have the GMO corn, live your Agenda 21 lifestyle, and we could all be out on the farmlands or in the nature. You know?
Precisely. That's, you know, our primer, our true mode of peace is one where we have a direct relationship with what I can only call God. We don't have intermediating priests. We are all gods. And that's one of the things that we recognize in ourselves, I think, more than other people, is that we are each one of us is an individual, is a god. We are descended from God, and our relationship is a direct one. It's an ancestral one. And the Anasatru, they talk about being descended from Odin, but I take it back further than that. So having this direct relationship and not intermediated by other people. Our primary relationship is not with other people. Our primary relationship is with nature, and secondarily with other people. We grow out our relationship with nature as the way in which our ancestors speak to us. And our ancestors go back beyond humans.
I agree.
And that's one of the things we have to understand about our relationship to nature. Our unique individualism is something where we have a very deep-rooted sense of identity with the roots of life.
But Jim, white people aren't indigenous anywhere. We're invaders. We're not native to the earth.
Well, you know, we have to understand that we were mentally enslaved. And, you know, so a lot of what we did during that period of time, I'm not saying that they're justified. You know, once you're in the regime of group selection where you've got like a Native American tribe fighting another one, and you know, us coming in and they're fighting us, you know, it's war. And you know, and what's justice and what's not justice? Well, it's who wins. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, so you don't have to give me any crap about this being indigenous and that and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, my once you're in a group selectionist environment, you're at war, and that's the only justice that there is which group wins. The thing is that we have to remember that selects for a direction. It's an evolutionary direction that ultimately destroys the individual integrity for group integrity. It makes us so that the thing that we think of as our God identity, the individual's integrity, the beautiful woman, the honorable man, you know, these things become subordinate to this group. And no, I look at the beauty of our woman. I mean, that's really why I look at it, is the beauty of our woman. I just, that's how I see my primary relationship with God is when I see that. So yes, there is a sense in which there's a social level that is primary in my mind, but it's sex. It's the recognition of the God nature of the opposite sex that embodies that which we as an individual of the other sex would lack in ourselves. And from that, we can then graduate. That educates us as to the value of the other. And we can then graduate beyond that into the recognition of the value of nature and the value of other people.
Well, I wish those European white boys over there would pick up their balls and take care of their streets, because there's women that are literally getting hit. We just posted a video of a Dutch girl who got knocked out by some Arabs. Rapes are occurring. Children are being abducted. And nothing's happening. It's almost like we need to have just a voluntary police force wandering the streets because our government's not taking care of it.
Right. That's why we have to get to the point where we have group identity of the type that I'm talking about, motivated, saying, look, what's going on here with the Dutch government is this is a gang that's preventing us from forming the kind of society that we want to form. And we have a right to. We have a fundamental right to have that kind of society. And as long as you can get to that point and recognize that this is an enemy, that this entity that's the Dutch government or the European Union or the United States government or whatever, you know, is an actual occupying army that is preventing us from having our own type of social organization that is our right to have. It's difficult to get people to form, to identify as anything but individuals. If you understand what I'm saying, that our group identity is taken over by these monstrosities that have no right to our identification with them.
Yeah.
We need to find other identities. And if it's like, you know, like I said, if it's a libertarian group, although to them that would be an anathema, or if it's a Nazi group, or if it's a communist group, whatever it is, it might be a Christian group, doesn't matter. Whatever kind of group it is, if it's your group, and it's being interfered with, you have to recognize other people that have different opinions from you also have a right to their quasi-religion or their social theory, and that you are all being violated by these monstrosities. And at that point, you have some basis for forming a federation that can fight back. You've got to get your identity. You've got to get your identity back from these governments that are out there right now, and identify with people that you can identify with in terms of what you believe in.
So what do you think of the pan-anarchist movement, where it's all kinds of different anarchists that are trying to get together just to fight the government right now?
Well, as long as they're willing to have, you know, other people like the libertarians or the minarchists or the national socialists or the communists or whatever, the Christians, you know, fundamentalist Christians, or there are all kinds of people out there that they need to recognize have a right to their own communities in which they want to raise their children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, as long as they recognize that, then, as far as I'm concerned, they're in, and they get their, you know, if they want to elect me, if people want me to be king, what I'll do is I'll stand up and say, I will live or die based upon the merits of this sortocracy. If you want to identify with me, you get your land rent stream, and you can then claim with others of like mind whatever territory you think you want to claim, regardless of what regime currently claims that land, and you have legitimate right to it. And then the question becomes, how do we organize to actually, you know, sequester that and get the right to these people exercising their freedom of, you want to call it religion, however you work it, but that's where you start to get things organized, is you get territories you've set aside that you're going to have, you're going to live and raise your children the way you see fit to raise them. And you're going to fight for that. You identify with allocating land that way, and you fight for it.
I agree. Last question for you. The expulsion of Jews from European kingdoms has occurred thousands of times for over thousands of years, and this problem used to be known, but why did this occur and why did it stop being known?
Well, part of the problem is that there wasn't enough communication between the kingdoms. And so people in one kingdom would be, well, think about it like this. You know, it's like I was saying about the virulence. You know, you have a guy lying in a couch over here, and you got another guy who's not diseased lying in a couch next to him. The guy dies of the virus. The disease escapes to the other guy. And so the guy that just died, you know, can't really say to the guy, you know, look, you know, this is a bad virus. He's dead, right? Now, you can observe the death of this other guy and try to learn something from that. But if your history is being written by a highly literate culture that obscures the social realities and obscures the results of experiments, for example, putting Jews into control of money or whatever, or in control of the banking system, then you're not going to learn. And eventually, when we got to the point that there was enough communication and there was enough centralization of the economies, I think that was the point at which we lost our ability to be independent. And we have to get back to the point where we have some more of this localization of autarky, basically, you know, more localized independence. And part of that ideal is to, as I said, get people so that they go into an area, claim it for their own, live the way they want to live. And many people are going to decide that they want to live with the food that they grow in the local area. You know, say one of the ideas is to have a county currency where the county government would be collecting currency that it issues. And so the county becomes a self-sufficient economy. And you get that kind of thing happening, and then, you know, you're not going to be as vulnerable to the manipulations from the central economic forces, and you're going to have more control over your own education, and you're going to have, because you're independent, you're going to be thinking more clearly. You're not going to be as biologically sort of enslaved to the larger economic structures, and therefore your mind is going to be freer.
Well, as we wind down, Jim, is there anything we missed and need to add to this first conversation?
I don't think so. I do think I'd like to talk a little bit more in the future more depth about this conflict between individual selection and group selection as a central question that people need to face, because we need to choose our evolutionary direction. And if we aren't careful about our evolutionary direction, even if we preserve ourselves, we could end up going into the ditch.
Please give us your website details and any other information you'd like to share.
Well, I've set up a website called sortocracy.org that has the minimalist rules for sortocracy and also has some discussion of jury nullification as being very important to allowing local rule. There's also a website that a blog that I put out called Feral Observations, you know, like a feral cat, except it's Feral Observations. That's just sort of my general observations about technology and sometimes about society.
Thanks again, Jim. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Well, everyone, this conversation with Jim only scratched the surface of some of these concepts. If you're interested in reading James's writings to delve in deeper, do a thorough Google search of James Bowery, as his writings are spread out across many websites. I can point you to a piece he wrote called 7 Points of Agreement Between Individuals, which is located at majorityrights.com. I want to say thank you to all our listeners and supporters, especially those who have been supporting us through the politically incorrect subject matters. You know who you are. RedIceCreations.com and Radio314.com are the websites where you'll find more. Next up on Radio 314 is Tim Murdoch and also Greg Johnson. And I will be releasing my review of the detestable TV show St. George. So look out for it on RedIceCreations.com and on our YouTube channel. I'm going to leave you with a German pagan metal band called Krom. The song is My Destiny. Have a great night.